Checkmate.
This is the Chestnut Checkers Podcast.
Checkmate.
Learn a new mindset to create wealth.
We need to be more independent thinkers, man.
Passive income.
Mathematics is precise.
A successful business.
Chess moves.
And money management strategies.
This is Chestnut Checkers.
So welcome to another episode of Chestnut Checkers, right? We got ex-NBA player Josh Childers with us today. Now, Josh was selected 6th overall in the 2004 draft by the Atlanta Hawks. Now, he's Compton Race. He's a Stanford graduate. He's the CEO of Landspar Group. Landspar Group is a Los Angeles-based real estate investment firm that revitalizes communities of color. We're here to talk to him about how pro athletes go broke, right? Because that's a big issue, and we always hear about this. But we want to know the reasons why, right? Because a lot of people think, Josh, that it would never happen to them. Like, they hear these big numbers, you know, 20 million, 50 million, whatever. And they say, look, man, that'll never happen to me, right? So we're going to discuss how that happens. But before we get into that, we want to know about Landspar Group, you know, the company that you run. And we want to know a little bit about what you do and tell us your goals, visions, and how you got started in investment and how you got started with that company. Hey, Josh, how you doing? Glad to have you.
Yeah. First and foremost, thanks for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity. And as I mentioned, off the recording, always great to see fellow hoopers turn businessmen and see succeeding. So congratulations on your success. And to start, I went to Stanford, and my scholarship donor at Stanford is a guy by the name of John Arriaga. He's a real estate mogul, did it at a high level for a long time. And so, you know, as an 18-year-old freshman, I was like, all right, how is this dude paying for my scholarship here? and, you know, realized that, you know, it was through the power of real estate. And that planted the seed for me early on. And, you know, now, shoot, almost 20 years later, you know, here I am starting a real estate company. And our focus really is on getting into under-resourced communities and impacting change to real estate development. So I'm from Compton, California. You know, it's not the nicest area. I've seen time and time again, real estate developers come in, you know, create some sort of development and or buy property, you know, make a ton of money and leave and go elsewhere, right? And so our focus was really centered around this new opportunity zone legislation that came out, and understanding that that was going to be, you know, the next wave for a lot of wealthy individuals. Go buy up, you know, inner city neighborhoods and under-resourced areas, you know, park their dollars there, reap all the tax rewards and benefits, and then most likely push the community stakeholders out through gentrification and other methods. And so we really wanted to target that and tackle that, you know, before those things started to kind of take place. So that was our genesis. And since then, we have about three projects, you know, in the works. We have a 300 unit development we're doing out in Las Vegas. We just closed on a hotel opportunity here in Southern California. And then we're doing a 70 to 80 unit development in Compton, California, which is where I'm from. So we're starting off, you know, the right way and in some pretty cool projects.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man. That's pretty cool that you're, it's always interesting how people are, you know, learn about these opportunities in investment, right? Because you said that you met a guy who was paying for your scholarship, correct?
Yeah.
And he was in real estate. So that made you, you know, see and say, you know, what is this guy doing? What is he into that, you know, that he's able to make so much money, right? Because, you know, minorities, you know, Hispanics and Blacks usually don't have that type of connections, right? They don't have people around them that are making money other than work for a company or, you know, something like that, right? So that's how, like, I grew up in poverty, right? So I didn't have a lot. When I got my first job, you know, after I played basketball, I went as a software engineer, right? So, and I was working at a company, right? And so I learned about stocks because there was a guy next to me and he was older. He was, you know, older white man. And he kind of took me under his wing, man, and just taught me about it, you know, over, you know, almost 15 years ago. And it's always, and that's the reason why, you know, you have to keep your network open. Mm-hmm. You have to bring people in your network that you normally wouldn't talk to, normally wouldn't, you know, associate with, because that's how new ideas come in, right? So it's interesting, you know, how you were able to make that connection with the real estate.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to your point, talk about keeping your network open, and that's such a vital thing for a lot of people, and it's something that I think we don't, you know, take as seriously as we should.
Exactly.
You gotta get uncomfortable being you got to get comfortable being uncomfortable and putting exactly. yourself in a position, you know, to be, let's say, outside of your comfort zone in networking events, in meetups, in areas that, you know, you can learn and grow and be the least qualified or least intelligent person in the room, because ultimately that leads to you getting more opportunities, you know, to learn and grow as a person. So that's what I tried to do, you know, when I was younger, and what I still try to do, you know, is to kind of level up my network and be around people who are successful and, you know, doing things that I think, if not add value to what I'm trying to do, add value to, you know, me as a person and kind of add things to my toolkit, if you will.
Exactly. Because, like, if you hang around people who are exactly like you, think exactly like you, nothing new is going to come in, right?
For sure. For sure.
All right. So I know this is almost a cliche, right? Because a lot of people talk about it. A lot of people, you know, they try to figure out what's happening, right? But with the concept of, you know, athletes going broke, right? Because I know there was a 30 for 30 on it, you know, before. I think it was, 3 or 4 years ago?
Yep.
Yeah. So people see all this money coming in and out. They're like, you know, that never happened to me. I would never, you know, how could you lose that much money? And then the same person is living check to check with like $80,000-$90,000 a year. So people don't realize that's just a scaled up problem. It's not, you know, it's not like you could, if you can't manage that, you probably couldn't manage the 30 million, you know,
right.
You just scaled up your problems. It's not like, oh, you know, if I can't live on this small amount, I can live on so much more. So what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, man, I think that the common misconception, you know, usually revolves around, they see that contract amount and not factor in, you know, the other expenses that just come off top, right? So you got taxes, you got agent fees, and you have you have the NBA escrow. And so that $100 million contract immediately gets cut to 50, right?
Yeah.
Then, you know, you have most people who are spending as though they have 100. And then, you know, you have a couple of bad investments, you know, you deal with, I don't know, you know, child support or, you know, any sorts of things like that. And, you know, guys, you know, those checks get eaten up pretty quickly. So, you know, there's a bunch of different variables that people don't really take into account because they just see that number flashed, you know, across the little ticker and assume that that's what that guy has.
Yeah.
It's not the case.
And a lot of people think they always, you know, people say, like, you know, they feel like that the majority of NBA players come from poverty. So maybe they can't handle the money or something like that, but that's a misconception, right? A lot of NBA players come from upper middle class homes. That's how they have access to the training. That's how they have access to the diets, whatever they got them to that level. So it's not a poverty problem so much. It's more of a like financial education problem.
Right, right. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. And I didn't necessarily come from poverty, you know, but I came from a working class family,
yeah.
You know, and my parents, you know, stretched to make things happen, you know, and put us in an opportunity to, you know, be successful from a sports perspective. And, you know, but there's no financial literacy being taught. I mean, you know, the biggest purchase for most families is their home. Outside of that, it's like, all right, I just need to make sure that I can, you know, cover my bills and, you know, take the family, you know, on a vacation maybe once a year and, you know, those little things. And so, you know, you give a 20-year-old kid, you know, a $10 million contract and expect them to just know it all. That's unrealistic. And, you know, I think anybody in their early 20s, you know, 18 to 21, you know, would probably be financially irresponsible.
Yeah, I probably would have. I'll tell you that right now.
to say after the fact, but the reality is, you know, nobody really knows what to do with that kind of money unless you, you know, had a family support system or support system around you that, you know, was educated financially and could help you through that process, which most people don't.
Most people don't, right?
Yeah.
And most people just don't. And I mean, it's a smaller problem even with the student loans, right? Is that you put a 18-year-old in college And then you tell them, look, man, you could take, you know, $10,000 a year in student loans. But most, they're like, I did it. You know, I maxed them out every year. Because in my mind, I didn't really associate like having to pay them back. I knew I had to. I knew one day was coming, but it was, it seemed so far out for me. It didn't matter, right? And that's what I think, people that young, man, they don't understand consequences yet. Or, you know, they just don't get it right. So when they get that much money, it's very important to have a strong, you know, network around you. And then that, you don't have that either. Mm-hmm. If you don't have both of those, it's almost, you know, inevitable what's going to happen, right? So if you have a short career, you know, and you don't have the time, you know, to learn and grow as a person and, you know, maybe make more on your second, third, fourth contract, you know, and you can go broke. It's very easy to happen, right? It's very easy.
Very easy. And it's one of those things that it's hard to relay that information to people who aren't in it or who don't understand it. You know, I mean, you look at the numbers and you think, you know, $1 million is a lot of money.
Yeah, it's not.
It is, but you know, in this landscape, you can lose $1 million and or spend $1 million very quickly.
Exactly.
And so I think, you know, the education and literacy component is so critical, which is why I appreciate what you're doing, because you're helping people, you know, make money, you know, by specific strategies that you've implemented. And, you know, those aren't things that, you know, they're learning outside of this platform. You know, it's not common knowledge, and that's on purpose.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, man, is I'm trying to like get people to change. You know, I talk about the stocks a lot. That's what's hot right now, right? So people want to hear about that. But when people come into like my network of podcasts, whatever, we talk about the financial literacy part. That's what draws them in. But this is when I try to teach them, you know, the proper mindset, you know, how to view money and how to, you know, prepare in the future, you know, how to store money up for the future, how to make sure that the money is there, and how to teach their children so that their generational wealth can continue down the line, right? So it's a full strategy. It's not just living day to day. Right. So, you know, we try to make sure we bring those people into that type of thinking. Right. Because like you said, the lack of financial literacy will hurt you worse than, you know, anything else. Right.
Absolutely.
Like, another thing we talk about, too, is that like something else you said earlier, you said that people see when you, let's say, for example, you get $1 million contract. Right. And you got $1 million in the bank. Most people see that million as something that I can spend the whole thing. Right, so I'm gonna buy a house for $300,000. Right. I'll buy a Lambo for $250,000. I still got $200,000 left. You know, I can live it. Nah, man. What? Like we try to teach people, you have to view money a different way. You have to look at money as the return I can draw on that capital. Mm-hmm. That's it. You know, so that ensures that you're gonna be well off for the rest of your life. So, well, how much can I get on $1 million? Well, you know, I could probably 7-8%, 9% with real estate, roughly. So that means I can get $90,000 a year from that. Now, what did that change your mindset, right? So now think about that. So you can spend $90,000 a year. Now is $1 million a lot. People are like, oh, it's not that much. You know, but that's how you have to look at it. You know, otherwise it's going to be gone.
Right, right. I remember, you know, when I negotiated my first contract, I negotiated 25% of my contract up front. And, you know, I was doing the math and, you know, I was on my little calculator doing, and I got that first check. I was like, I cannot believe, like, I had never seen so much money taken out of a check before. I was so pissed off. But, you know, the tax component alone, you know, is a beast. So, you know, you mix that with, you know, all the other expenses, you know, I can't go out by the house that I thought I could go out by, you know. And I think, you know, when you talk about your platform being Chestnut Checkers, you know, this system is set up for professionals in other avenues to really generate that or create that generational wealth. And so like now after retirement, I'm seeing the benefits of being a real estate professional versus, you know, being a salaried professional and, you know, how I can depreciate assets and write things off. Exactly. And, you know, do all of those things, you know, where, you know, my tax bill isn't what it was. And, you know, that's how you start to generate you know, the wealth that you can keep. And so, yeah, it's about finding those nuances and understanding how the game's played, you know, which, like I said before, it's kept a secret on purpose.
Exactly. That's what I tell people. I said a lot of these things are kept away from you on purpose because you got to remember, man, life is competitive. Finances are competitive. So if they got everybody on this side, you know, doing right. all these things, then they're going to, you know, the leader going to lose out. So they keep it away on purpose. Right. They keep you, you know, they need employees for their jobs. They need people at a certain level so that they can benefit from them, right? So there's a reason why people don't hear about these things, right? Because they're not supposed to.
Exactly. So, you know, it's a part of the learning process and the growth. Obviously, social media has allowed more people to get access to this stuff.
Yeah.
Powerful. You know, but I think, you know, there's a long way that a lot of people need to go in terms of learning this stuff and implementing this stuff in their lives, you know, so that, you know, people aren't living check to check and that people do understand, you know, the power of real estate or of stocks or of, you know, just getting outside of that box that everybody sits in and think that they have to work, you know, a 9 to 5 until they're 65 years old, you know, and then enjoy 10 years of retirement. Like that's, I feel like that mindset is so old school and, you know, really is not progressive in any capacity. So, you know, the more people you can get to think outside of that and understand, you know, there are other ways to create wealth and, you know, to you know, not trade time for money is crucial.
Yeah. And that's what I tell people. That's what I talk to people about, the same type of thing, right? Is that, and you touched on it before, you said, you know, society is set up for, you know, in a certain way to keep you away from certain ideas, certain concepts. And one of the things I think is part of that society's plan is that they'll, like, people believe that they can save their way to wealth. Like they can just, you know, I can save my money. If I'm smart, you know, I don't spend a lot for, you know, 30 years. When I'm 30, 40, it'll pay off, right? And I feel like that's almost like, it's not like I don't think it's a conspiracy, but I think it's a way to keep you out of the game until you're 60. So when you're 60, you realize, man, I barely beat inflation, you know? So, I mean, and I deal with that for 30 years and I didn't have as much as I thought I would have, you know? And then it's too late. You're 60, your whole life's over and they've kept you out of the game the entire time. So they've kept you on the sidelines while they were generating wealth the whole time. So it's like almost like a strategy to keep people away because like we said, wealth creation is competitive. Every dollar you get, somebody somewhere, you know, had to give it to you, right? So it's competitive and it's almost a zero-sum game, except for the Fed prints money into the system, but it's still, value is still a zero-sum game. So the total value of the system is still, you know, it only shifts really. So that's a way to keep you, you know, on the sidelines while the elite, while the banks, while the institutions continue to build wealth.
Yeah. And I think it leads to, it's a scarcity mindset around it.
That's
right?
It.
You know, when you understand that there is so much opportunity out there and, you know, you're not, you know, holding everything.
Exactly.
Or holding all those acorns, you know, through the winter. It's like, there's ways for you to start, you know, picking up extra, you know, extra income, extra passive income, which is little tweaks, right? And so, you know, shifting that mindset is hard. You know, I know a lot of people who are, you know, stuck in the you know, retire at 65 and, you know, just save my money kind of mentality. And like, at some point, you're just like, all right, that's what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Do your thing. You know, but I'm over here actively trying to find ways, you know, to create other revenue streams for myself, you know, that I can eventually, you know, pass down to my children and or, you know, just kind of build in other verticals, right? And so you systemize and create something that's now optimized and running, you know, at the right capacity, and then you move on to the next. And, you know, you look up 5-7 years from now, you have 5 to 7, you know, different verticals that are, you know, generating a nice return. And that's how you start to really generate like that generational kind of wealth.
And in the process, you've lowered the risk, you know, because you got 7 streams of income in 7 different industries, 7 different things going on. The odds that all of them are going to go away is almost zero. That's one thing that always got me when I was younger is that people would have one job and they would feel, you know, like they would have all of their eggs, basically, to be honest, in one basket. That job goes away, or they decide to fire you, it's all over. Mm-hmm. And then people, and it's funny to me that people feel safer in like that. They feel safer in the one job. And I'm like, man, all it takes is one dude that you may not even know, maybe at corporate, maybe in your own building or whatever, to decide, you know, draw a red line and say, everybody below this line is gone. And that's the end of your career. Right. So then you have to start over. And some people, you know, they get in jobs, and if you've been there so long, you understand only what that particular job does. You can't even work anywhere else, you know, because you've been there so long, you know, every different, you know, job does different things differently. So you've grown accustomed to how they do it. Mm-hmm. Right. So some people, like, you've been working somewhere 20, 30 years, you can't go anywhere else. That's right. It, you know? So, and like I said, is that your risk is actually less when you have multiple streams of income as opposed to just one.
Right. No, I agree 100%. And I think making sure that you understand that mentality before you get into, you know, trying to build multiple streams is crucial. Because if you think everything is going to be a quick hitter and is not going to require work, you know, you're mistaken. It's not easy to do these things. It's just, it allows you the freedom to then go and, you know, do what you want to do, you know, with your time. You know, if I have something that's, you know, on cruise control that's generating $500 to $1 million a year, I don't have to sit there behind a desk and work, you know, my life away. I can go spend time with my family and do vacations, build something else cool, do what I want to do. But it's this, you know, false sense of security that people have that the corporate route is always the best route. And certain people get it and certain people don't.
And some people never get it, man. They just, they can't see it. And I think it's the fear.
Yeah.
The fear of something new, the fear of doing something different is what blocks their ability to see past that, you know. And actually, you know, if you tell somebody, look, man, if like somebody is looking at it objectively, right? And you say, look, you got seven streams of income in seven different industries, or you got one job. Like the average person would see that. But once you put, you know, the fear and the fear of the unknown or whatever inside that equation, then it alters how they see the situation, you know. And it's all, yeah, you know, I'd rather be at this one job, you know. But that's actually, like I said, the most riskful thing you can do in that situation.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I'll beat my head against the wall trying to explain it to people, but
some people won't understand. Some people will actually, to be honest, because their fear is what draws them, they'll get angry at you for even like confronting them about, you know, that the way they see the world. Because it's actually fear driving that decision, driving that reaction. It's because you say, look, what you're doing is actually risky, and they'll get angry at you. Like, no, you know, they'll argue with it. They'll get angry. They'll lash out at you because you're, that's their, you know, safe zone.
Right.
Is that the way they see the world right now. And they don't want anybody coming in to like try to change that.
Right. No, I agree.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about, go back to how, you know, pro athletes go broke. Right. I saw a previous interview you did, and you talked about the influence of veteran players who make a lot more than you do, right? So, and that's something that people never talk about, right? Because I played in Puerto Rico, right? And I played with Santurce. And J.J. Barrera, that plays now for the Mavericks, he was on our team, right? That's before he went to the NBA. It was a year before he went to the NBA. And what I made and what he made was like 50 times difference, you know? So, I mean, he could do stuff I couldn't do, man.
Right.
If I tried to do what he was doing, I would have went broke, right? So the people don't know that, they don't see that difference when you talk about millions. Like, this one guy makes $5 million, this other guy makes 50. The average person, they kind of see that as equal. It's not equal, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's when you take that, it's a kind of a microcosm of, you know, the country, right? You know, people are spending money like they see, you know, others around them spend. And, you know, you can't keep up with everybody. You know, I know a number of people, or, you know, I've seen it firsthand, you know, rookies come into the league, you know, they're financially uneducated. You know, you have a veteran who's probably also financially uneducated. He just has a little bit more horsepower behind him to play with. And, you know, he can make some sillier decisions and not feel the effects of it. And so, you know, that's such an important and underrated thing that I think, happens in the league. You know, I had a mixture of both you know, responsible and irresponsible veterans. And I tried to, you know, kind of listen to things that both said. And, you know, I made some mistakes along the way, just as, you know, any young kid would. But at the end of the day, I felt compelled to, you know, try and then pass what I learned on to some of the younger guys and, you know, help them, you know, navigate the game a little bit easier than I did. So, you know, having good veterans, not only from a professional perspective in terms of just, you know, your learning how to be a pro is important, but also learning how to, you know, navigate the pitfalls of family and friends and, you know, bad investments, who's a bad money manager, you know, what are you looking at? You know, what sorts of VC deals are you involved in? You know, all these things that kind of come about, you know, are really driven by, you know, who you surround yourself with. And, you know, for 7 months out of the year, you know, that's your teammates. So, you know, making sure that you have a good group of guys is crucial. I remember one kind of short story, myself and Marvin Williams, Carolina guy, actually just retired, had a nice career. We had a little bet on who can save the most per diem, right? And it became a thing on the team plane when we would get that per diem check, and everybody's like, "Oh, y'all cheap, what y'all gonna do?" You know, but it was more so, you know, it was easy to land in the city and go eat at, you know, the hotel that we stayed at, which was usually like a Ritz-Carlton or some, you know, some high-end hotel. And, you know, you get that room service bill and it's, you know, $70 for a hamburger and fries, or, you know, whatever, it was astronomically more than it needs to be. Yeah. You know, versus getting your butt up, walking down the street to the restaurant, you know, and spending $15 or $20 on that meal. Yeah. And it's just simple things like that, you know, where you see younger guys, you know, come in and just do what the veteran guys do, you know, versus actually, like, you know, looking at what makes sense. And, you know, the more expensive meal necessarily doesn't make sense all the time. There are some nights where you just don't feel like, whatever, you just, you know, you pay the extra money. But, you know, most of the time you can go out and save a nice chunk of change just by, you know, getting your butt out of bed and walking down the street. So, stuff like that, man, that we tried to do, and it's just a mindset more than anything.
Yeah, it's just trying to create a mindset, man, and that those type of games are, you know, do work, right? Is that, and I've done that too when I was younger, things like that, to see, you know, how much you can, like, I had a similar story, like, because I had a guy I lived with when I was in Puerto Rico, and we would try to see how cheaply we could eat every day, and he actually got down to $1.80. Duty rice and beef, and it was like balanced meals. Yeah, this is like, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But he was eating for $1.80 a day, and it was balanced meals, man, because he would make sure he got his protein and everything, and he would use like rice as a base on, you know, for all his meal, and he would put, you know, the beans with the proteins, and he got down to $1.80 a day. I could never get that low, but he's a healthy dude. You know, he's in shape and everything. So, but those type of games, like you said, they teach you and they create a mindset when you're young, especially, right? Yeah. They help you, you know, understand your limits and understand what you can do, you know, and how to, you know, grow as a person and how to view money differently.
Right. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And there's a book that I read kind of speaks on that. It's called The Power of Habit. Yeah. And I'm not sure if you check that one out. But you start to pay attention in further detail to certain things in your life. And it's a trickle down effect into other areas. Yeah. So, you know, if you're, for example, counting calories, you know, to make sure that you're, you know, on a strict, you know, caloric diet for the day, that then trickles over into, you know, you counting, you know, you checking your budget more, or you doing other things in your life, you know, a little bit more meticulously. And, you know, it's just that habit of, you know, being detail oriented, that I think a lot of us, you know, lack. One of the things that I hate when I do it, but I do it all the time, I'll sign up for it like a subscription of something, and then I'll use it for a couple months, and then I won't use it anymore, and I'll see, you know, the thing pop up on my bill. Why haven't I canceled that, right? And it's just one of those things, like, it, you know, unless you really get in the mindset of being detail oriented and meticulous, you know, you lose track of stuff. So, you know, the changing your habits, changing your mindset, and being more detail oriented is something I'm definitely working on as a person.
Yeah, and like I said, I think a lot of people do that. That's the reason why the subscription business model is pushed now, because a lot of people forget that, right? They just let it go, man. Especially if the price is low enough, people just forget about it, right? So I think that's why a lot of companies are moving, like a lot, especially software companies, they figured that out. Like Adobe, they used to, Photoshop used to be like a $2,000 program. Then they reorganized everything. Now you pay like $20 a month. So I bet you the lifetime value of that customer is probably more because they forget to cancel their subscriptions, right? As opposed to paying the $2,000 up front.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So just back to what the veterans, right? So you watch them, and now I want to make a connection with real life, right? It's because, you got veterans like I talked about, and you spoke about, is that they make a lot more than you, and you try to live up to what they're doing, right? And I was watching a documentary. It may have been like 2 months ago, and I forget the name of it, but it's on YouTube and it was free. And it was a sociologist, and she was from Yale. I forget her name, but the documentary was talking about how society as a whole has went more upscale because of social media, right? Is that, and you're around my age, right? And when we were in high school, everybody wore Hilfiger, and what we were aspiring to was a middle class, upper middle class lifestyle. That's what most people did now. But the kids now, that's nothing. They aspire Gucci and an affluent lifestyle. That's what everybody aspires now. So it causes them to spend more than they should, right? Because they're trying to match these people they see on social media, to match the celebrities. No, that affluent, that the upper middle class lifestyle is no longer acceptable anymore. Mm-hmm. You want to go past that. And that causes people to spend money they don't have and get into a lot of debt and financial issues. The vacations, because, that's real big on Instagram, is that everybody goes on vacation. So, it's the same thing as, watching a veteran spend money. It's the same situation. That's why I want to make these connections, because people see athletes doing these things or, celebrities or whatever, and they go broke, and it's all, that'll never happen to me. But it would if you didn't watch it, right?
Yeah, for sure. I would love to see that documentary. That sounds really cool.
I'll send it to you.
I was like trying to get the Sean John velour suit,
I know. I was just trying to have enough to wear Hilfiger every day.
Right. Hilfiger.
Sean John too, right?
Whatever, but like,
Gucci. I don't even know Gucci. I heard about it, but I never saw anybody with it. So,
I mean, you saw a little fake bags here and there, but
clothes. I knew they made bags and stuff. I didn't know they made clothes and stuff. I never know anybody in my high school never wore that, so I didn't see it.
Same. And it's super interesting because it's true. I see kids, high school kids on Instagram, now rocking in the Balenciagas and the Gucci's and the all this expensive stuff. And I'm like, I was trying to get the latest Air Max. And the latest Jordan. And so, taste is definitely, the expense of taste has definitely changed, and people's kind of aspirations of that luxury goods mindset is definitely kind of set in. But I think, back to when I purchased those things, I was like, stuff really ain't that comfortable. No. It looks nice for a minute, and then the next season they got something different. And so it's like, how can I, keep this in perspective? If there's a nice piece that I like, cool, but this isn't what I aspire to be, and this isn't the lifestyle that I need to have. I remember seeing this meme all over the internet, but it talks about it had a picture of Bill Gates and I think Zuckerberg, and it was like, not a Gucci belt in sight. And it's like, combined net worth of however many billion dollars. And, it's just, the materialistic things that we see on Instagram, are a distraction. I know guys who, now are like, how many properties can I collect? And I'm like, that's
right.
Because that's sustainable, that's long lasting, and that's actually something that, adds to versus subtracts from your life. So, just shifting that mindset, man, and trying to, attain to, or either that or allowing the cash flow to purchase you know, whatever it is that you like to, you know, to splurge on. But, you know, having an investor's mentality first, and then, you know, the other side, the consumer mentality second, would be maybe something that people can shift to.
And I talk about that often because that's, you know, it's a constant battle with yourself, right? Because society, like we said, society will push you, try to get you to, you know, because marketing is based on driving emotion. They want you to make emotional decisions. That's what the car ads, that's what the clothes, all the ads are trying to make you make an emotional decision based on some, you know, some type of emotion, you know, usually fear, uncertainty, doubt, or, you know, just, you know, maybe wanting to be happy or whatever. That's all marketing is, most of it. So all around you every day, you have these emotional drivers trying to get you to purchase things, right? So you have to constantly fight back against that, right? So, and then, like, that's what I tell people is that, you know, it's going to be a fight. You know, you're going to want stuff, but you have to think logically. Like we said, like chestnut checkers, you have to think like, you know, so I want this item, right? I want a new car, right? So, you know, I have the money to pay. I could just buy it, but is that the best thing to do? Well, I'm going to use this money and I'm going to put it into investments. And then once I get these in investments, create that cash flow to pay for this, you know, this car. And then I'll reward myself and I'll go buy the car. Mm-hmm. That's okay to do that, right? But just letting your emotions drive you going out and just, you know, writing a check for the car. That's where the problem lies, right? Is that you just have to make sure, you know, it's okay to like you said, it's okay to want nice things. It's okay to, you know, like I said, I like some nice things, but like I'm with you too, is that I just want to be comfortable in some stuff, right? So, and like say for example, like the Versace underwear, right? Like I Walmart's right across the street, you know, so I'm not going to drive like all the way across town, you know, just, if I need some underwear, just go to Walmart and get some Hanes, man. It's easier.
Right.
You know, so, I'm like, I'm not going to go out of my way for certain stuff, man. So, you know, but like I said, I know what you mean is that sometimes it's just about being comfortable, right? But like we said, we do have those emotional drivers trying to get us to do things like, you know, instantly buy cars. They don't want you to think. They want you to act off emotion. So you just got to constantly think about that and try to, you know, come up with ways to stop those emotional, you know, reactions that cause you to buy things you don't need or want, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I've been in an internal battle for the last 5 years. I've been wanting to buy a new car.
Yeah.
And I'm still like holding strong. I bought my last car in 2014. And I've just kept the same. I got two cars. I kept the same two cars. And I've been wanting this Range Rover for the longest. I'm just like, I just can't bring myself to do it, you know, because I'm like, all right, well, I can just invest that money into something else,
yeah.
You know, a hard money loan, whatever it is. And I see the cash flow that I can create doing other things. And I'm more attracted to that than I am to the car. So it's a battle. It's a struggle.
It's a struggle, man.
See things,
we're all humans.
Driving down the street every day, nice new, brand new, you know, big body. But, you know, how well can you resist that urge and understand that, you know, if you can create something that, you know, can generate, you know, cash flow for you, you know, and you don't have to trade time for money, that's more powerful.
Exactly. All right. So I just want to talk a little bit about the real estate market. I know you're heavy in the real estate, right? You're you know, your Landspire Group is a real estate investment firm, but I just wanted to get your opinions on where you think the real estate market's going. Now, I know, you know, the interest rates dropped a lot.
Yep.
But we know that there's a high demand right now for real estate, especially in California where you're from. I saw a chart and it said that like the private prices have went up like astronomically in California over the last, since 2000, I think 12,
mm-hmm.
You know, some prices have doubled or tripled. So, where do you see the real estate going into 2000, real estate market going into 2021?
Well, I think, and I don't deal necessarily in the residential space. I'm more in the commercial space, but I think from a residential perspective, from what I've seen, you're seeing more and more people move into secondary and tertiary markets. And so we're kind of doubling down on some of these areas, hence like Vegas, you know, Reno, people are moving out of California because it's so expensive,
mm-hmm.
You know, and moving into areas like those, like, you know, Texas, Florida, Charlotte, you know, South Carolina, like just other areas, you know, other markets that are much more affordable. And so with, you know, the impact that COVID has had on the office life and working from home has become more new, more prevalent. Mm-hmm. You know, people are, you know, these tech employees that are in San Francisco that are making, you know, $300,000 a year, you know, that we're paying, you know, $4,000 a month for a studio apartment. Like, all right, well, I can go, you know, and live, you know, in a nicer area, work from home, and I can actually own something. Exactly. And so you're seeing this millennial flight is kind of what we've been calling it, where, you know, they're moving into these markets that they're affordable. You know, they're starting families later, you know, which then allows them to, you know, just enjoy life and live in highly amenitized, you know, apartments. People are renting longer. So, you know, I say all that to say that we are, you know, really kind of focused on these secondary markets, you know, like Vegas, like Reno, like Sacramento, like, you know, Dallas, Austin, Atlanta, you know, some of these areas that are just much more affordable.
All right. So you spoke about commercial real estate, right? So what are some benefits or some advantages of being in commercial as opposed to residential?
I think it's just scalability. You know, anything over 4 units is considered commercial. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for us, you know, the projects that we're involved in now, one is a 300 unit. One is, you know, a 70, anywhere between 70 to 80 units. You know, we're looking at, you know, larger properties, 100 units and up, just because, you know, you can scale the operations, you can bring in better property managers, and, you know, the amount of work it takes to do, you know, the diligence and kind of put the deal together, you know, is roughly the same as it is for a smaller property. So, you know, we want to make sure that we have, you know, the ability to, you know, mitigate risk. You know, if we have 1 to 5 tenants that just, you know, are hit hard by COVID and need to move out, you know, in a 100 unit building, we still have 95, you know, tenants paying rent. Versus, you know, being in a 4 unit, you know, that thing is sitting empty. So it's just scaling up and allowing yourself the opportunity to, you know, mitigate some risk and also attract other investors.
All right. So how do you feel about real estate investment trust?
I honestly haven't gotten too much into those.
Oh, okay.
I've been on the private side more so. I was looking at them, but you know, I just kind of focused on the opportunities that are in front of me. You know, it's obviously, you know, a bit more passive and you know, it's more, you know, like the stock market, which, you know, if you're seasoned in that sense, you can probably do pretty well with it. But I've been more on the private side.
All right. So I just want to ask you one question for those who are listening is that, you know, we're all, either investors or potential investors, right? So are there any opportunities or any insight you can give us on the real estate market? Maybe some things that we can, you know, either take advantage of or maybe benefit from.
Yeah, I would say based on what markets you're in, you know, one of the things that I like to do is, you know, drive around town and, you know, see properties that are mismanaged. You know, if you see, I don't know, wiring that's off, if you see, you know, a couple of units that are down, if you see some fire damage, you know, areas where you can go in and, you know, create value, I think are crucial. And that's where you can go in and pick up things at a discount. You know, right now with COVID, there's a lot of owner operated, you know, properties across the country that are being mismanaged. And or, you know, the owner might need some relief. So, you know, being diligent in that regard, you know, people use skip tracing. I haven't tried it enough to really know how well it works, you know, but they'll find owners that don't live in the state, you know, that, you know, just don't have an eye on the property as much as they should. And so those are kind of the prime pickings for real estate investors. To get, you know, deep valued property. So perfect example, we just closed on a property, you know, alongside another two groups that the owners are based in Washington, D.C., but the property is here in Southern California. Through COVID, it's been hit hard, and we were able to get that thing at a, you know, a 40% discount. So
that's pretty good, man.
You know, things like that, you know, that's where you can create value and you know, pick up good properties. Just takes diligence and work. I mean, just like you talk about, you know, getting up early, reading the market, understanding, you know, the metrics behind companies and you know, what's popular, what, you know, how do you read, you know, if a company is going to be successful or not, you know, and how can you kind of get in there, you know, before the value is created or realized. It's the same thing in real estate, you know,
same thing, right?
Same exact mentality.
That's what I'm saying. Like when investing, when it comes to real estate, stock market or whatever, beginners always want a number they can look at. Like, should I buy this when this is that number? It doesn't work like that. You have to build up several different, you know, skill sets to be able to see these opportunities before they form. That's what you just spoke of, you know, is that you have to be able to see the value before it's, you know, see the value or either create the value before it's there. Otherwise, you're just chasing, you know. That's what I would try to make sure people understand, right? So anything else you want to add here?
Yeah, just keep learning. Like, that's the biggest thing. That's what I'm trying to do. You know, this game is not super complicated if you
not really
educate yourself. And you know, and then you know, the biggest thing you can do after that is, you know, find a close friend or family member and help them. You know, and just create a network.
That's right.
That you know can do deals together. You know, and you can kind of build each other up. So, you know, stay diligent, keep learning, and keep following you, man.
I appreciate that, man. All right, man. So I'm going to send you that documentary link, though, as soon as we get off here and we get everything tied up here. I'll send it to you because it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I'll add the link also in my in this podcast description for those who are listening. They may want to look at it, but it's pretty interesting. I want you guys to take a look at it.
Sounds good.
Sorry, right, Josh. I appreciate your time, man. I appreciate you joining us, and have a great night, man.
You too, Armando. Thank you.